would be another blunder. Before I share my blunder, thanks for leading today, Danita. Our volunteer team is doing an excellent job. And Danita was in charge of, and then actually was the speaker at the ladies' tea yesterday. And then she was down here last night leading the worship, and she's doing this morning. And, you know, Kevin, if she just goes home and crashes this afternoon, she'll be all right. Thank you very much. My blunder. Quite often when we're singing a song, Carol and I will look at each other and we'll connect on what that song reminds us of, usually event, a place, whatever. And so we started to sing, "I'd Rather Have Jesus," and she looked over at me and she said, "Where is your mind?" And I said, "Well, it's on a Billy Graham crusade with Bev Shea singing it." And actually, I could have added to that a camp that I went to as a little kid in Colorado that was called Camp Idra Haji, "I'd Rather Have Jesus." And she looked at me in her loving way and she said, "Wrong answer." And as the words came out of her mouth, I realized what I was supposed to say. Almost 51 years ago at our wedding in Eugene, Cheryl Grimes sang "We'd Rather Have Jesus" at our wedding. Right answer. Probably should remember that ahead of anything that has to do with anybody else, right? I do remember a couple other songs we had at our wedding. I won't sing it, but "Hand in Hand We'll Walk Together," "Darling, You and I," "Fair or Cloudy Be the Weather," "Dark or Bright the Sky." All right, I'll be serious now. That was serious, wasn't it? We looked at Proverbs last week. I think Proverbs is all about helping us be a good person. Principle after principle. I think if we follow them prayerfully and carefully, we will be a good person. That should be our goal. Then comes Ecclesiastes. Some people think it shouldn't even be in the Bible, because it doesn't sound, much of it, several passages are great, but a lot of it sounds like something that God wouldn't say. Guess what? He didn't. It's a man looking at life from a human perspective. It's a human who apparently knew a lot. In fact, he refers to himself as a wise person, and all indications are that Solomon, who was the wisest man of his time, wrote it. I'm guessing it was later in life, after Solomon had made some really bad choices, some terrible decisions, had actually violated God's law, and in the most wealthy position on the planet, with the ability to have anything he wanted, we would call it today the good life. He sounds very much different from a good person. I'm so glad God included this book in his Bible, because we need to review on what happens when we lose perspective and think now rather than big picture of forever. I think that's the overriding situation in this book. So what I want to do, you have some head points, some titles in your notes, and I want to highlight just a few of what I called the part that troubles us about Ecclesiastes. Just a few paragraphs and comment on them and offer a solution to that, because I think any one of us can fall into these traps. Now, I don't get at all surprised when somebody who's not a child of God pursues wealth and gets bored with routine and thinks that work becomes useless and is all upset with injustice and pursues pleasure and finds out how empty it can be. Because somebody who doesn't know God, who doesn't have Christ in our life, then the focus is earth. It doesn't have the eternal big picture. But this is a man of God that's writing this. And I think these attitudes can happen to any of God's children at any time if we lose perspective on who God is and why we're on this planet. So it troubles us to hear some of this. Chapter 1, I called it the reality of routine. And we all have routines. It says in verse 2, meaningless, meaningless. This is out of the NIV. Everything is meaningless. What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? And then he talks about this routine. Verse 4. Generations come, generations go. Earth remains forever. Sun rises, sun sets, hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south, turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning to its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. And it goes on. What has happened? Well, I think what's happened is that this person has ceased to view each day as a gift from God. And that can happen to anybody. We need to remember Psalm 118:24. This is the day the Lord has made. We'll rejoice and be glad in it. Every day is a good day. And if we lose that perspective, we'll get into this ho-hum, humdrum attitude of, here we go again. You know, every day is a good day if God made it. And God makes every day. He doesn't make good days and bad days. We qualify them as good days and bad days based on experience. We need to take a step back from that and say, every day is a good day. Some of them are filled with all sorts of crud, heartache, weariness, but they're still a good day. You say, really? So the day that you got fired from your job, was that a good day? Absolutely. Didn't feel good. You didn't call it a good day. God called it a good day. He says, I made that day and I gave it to you. And my good day isn't changed by your crummy experience. And if we take that attitude towards that, we will learn from those experiences. Does it feel like a good day when finances crash? Doesn't feel good, but God made that day. Does it feel good when a relationship broke up? Doesn't feel good, but that doesn't change that God made a good day. Does it automatically become a bad day when a loved one dies? It was a good day. It's a painful experience, but it's a good day. Is it a good day when we get told we have a terminal illness? Sure, it's a good day. I believe the writer here lost perspective on what makes a good day, and therefore life became boring. And it can happen to anybody. We need to view each day as a gift from God. That'll take some grace. That'll take some trust. That'll take some discipline. And we probably won't completely conquer that as long as we're on this planet. I can assure you that today Lillian Bauer knows what a good day is. And she's in the place where there is no day or night. And then in chapter 2, I called it the reality of pleasure. And listen to this guy. Talk about a temporary outlook. I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Here's someone who's lost perspective of building a good person and is seeking the good life. And in verses 4 through 9, he talks about all the things that he accomplished beyond anybody that had been in Jerusalem before. Amazing. Verse 10, he says, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my work. And this was the reward for all my labor. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, Everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. What happened to him? He lost the temporary aspect of life. He focused on the temporary aspect of life, and he failed to look at the eternal. What do you do for that? You focus on people instead of things. You focus on people, because that's what matters to God. You're not concerned about things, stuff. It comes and goes. It's all earthy. It's good. It's wonderful. But it has no permanent satisfaction. That's why people who pursue pleasure never get enough, because it has a temporary fix, but it doesn't last. And then he got one that's really close to all of us in chapter 2, verse 17, hard work. What happened there? So I hated life, verse 17 of chapter 2, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. And he goes on to describe that, because work lost its fulfillment. Do we teach our kids that work is a gift from God? You remember Adam in his perfection before sin entered the human race was told to work. And he didn't sweat. He didn't get all worked up and exhausted. He had enjoyment in the accomplishment that God had given him in an assignment. And just because sin has entered in, and we have thorns and thistles and weariness and all the things that make work more difficult, it doesn't change the principle that God designed us to enjoy work. But for the sake of work, I don't think so. Because all that we accomplish with our hands, we earn a paycheck, we get a job done, we build a house, all those great things. But if that's our focus and we lose sight of the big picture, work will become meaningless. It will lose its fulfillment. So what do you do with that? When you've been in your job for 30 years and you've been doing the same thing over and over again, and you're concerned about what's going to happen from everything that you have collected, that it's going to go to somebody and they might just squander it, what do you do with that? How do you keep your focus? Well, one, I think you focus on legacy. Legacy. We need to leave a legacy that's positive, that people can follow and say, I learned from that man, that woman, how to do work and how to stay excited about it and positive. I learned a work ethic that changes my life. It's not just about us, it's about others. And I think we focus on integrity. No matter what the job is, no matter how monotonous it might become, no matter how little fulfillment we might get, we say, you know what? Integrity. Honesty. Because that's where we show what we're really made out of. Whether we're known as a person that's honest and careful and diligent, person of integrity. Example. You see, if it's just work for the sake of work, it might become not so enjoyable. But it's bigger than that. We're left on earth for a bigger purpose than just the things we do with our hands. And then he looked at how unfair life is. Chapter 3, verse 16. I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. And I looked again, and this is chapter 4, verse 1. I saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed. And they have no comforter. Power was on the side of the oppressors, and they have no comforter. And I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive, but better than both is he who has not even been born, who has not seen evil, all that's done under the sun. This guy is just weary of the injustice that takes place among people. Is that relevant or what? We talk about it all the time. That's not fair. They shouldn't be able to do that. They take advantage of this person. That's a sin-cursed world. And if we focus in on that, we will lose perspective. And we will lose the understanding of what God's desire really is, and that's that people would know him. It's bigger than the unfairnesses of life. It's bigger than the reality of the situation. Because God is always fair. Sometimes we say, God, I don't think you're being fair. That's the human expression trying to deal with the uglies of life. God is always fair. He is always fair. And we may be in heaven before we see some of the reality of that fairness. But that doesn't change anything from his perspective. So what's the solution to this one? Well, let God be God. Just let him be God. Don't try to do his work for him or fix his plans. If we're going to try to straighten everything out on planet Earth and make it fair, not going to happen. God's the one that'll do that. So we have to leave it with him. And then something that's so relevant to the good life, wealth. If I could only get enough money, I would have all the happiness in the world. Chapter 5, verse 10. Whoever loves money never has enough money. You know what the key there is? Whoever loves it. The Bible never says that money is evil. It does say the love of money is the root of all evil. When we move from the enjoyment of wealth and what we can do with that to make our life better and someone else's life better and start hoarding it and building it up and following the story that Jesus told of the rich man who, when he had more than he needed and should have been giving it away, he says, I'll build bigger barns. When we do that, we become very unsatisfied. And the reality of wealth is that it becomes meaningless. It simply does not satisfy. Someone reminded me this week, and we were in a conversation, and they said, let's face it. If we have clothes, at least one set, and food, maybe breakfast today, and a shelter over our body tonight, we have everything that we need. Till tomorrow, right? And we don't know where we'll be tomorrow. Now, I'm not in any way suggesting that we shouldn't plan and prepare and save and manage, because that's biblical as well. But when it comes right down to it, the wealth that we need is whatever it takes to get through today. Everything else is a bonus. Everything else is abundance. And I believe that the pursuit of wealth destroys people and takes the satisfaction out of life. Whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. Isn't that the truth? And what benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them? And it goes on to describe that. What's the solution to this pursuit of wealth that doesn't satisfy? Invest it in people. Give it away. I have admitted to myself and to a few people, our elders, that there's an area of leadership that I have neglected in my years at Wood Village Baptist Church. I'm sure there's a number of them, but there's one that's really bugging me big time. I have failed to teach the Wood Village family adequately on the principle, the need for, and the joy of giving financially. I admit that. Got some specific things in place to work on that. Don't get nervous. I'm not going to start preaching a whole bunch of sermons on giving. That probably would accomplish as little as some of the neglect that I feel like I've done. But I've been observing. I don't see what anybody gives, but I do see a report every year of age categories and the number of people who contribute. I have no idea what any of you give to the church. But I do know the numbers of families in the various age categories who contribute something. And 80% of the financial base of Wood Village Baptist Church comes from people 55 and older. So I commend you. Most of you in this room are in that category. 85% of the financial base for global missions comes from 55 and older. And as you go down the younger age groups, it gets a little frightening. So you do the math of what's going to happen to our church over the next 10 to 20 years. So I've been talking to some people to find out some ways to encourage people to learn the joy of giving. We'll be in a couple weeks talking about some special promotions for our church vans. And I was encouraged to come up with a project that everybody, little kids all the way up to old guys like me, could be more conscious of learning to give. And we're going to play on that because we want little kids and their parents to have something that causes them to say, this is important, this is God's work, and we can be a part of that. Because I believe that the American culture has affected the church, our church, and that we're not helping people enjoy the blessing and the benefit of giving financially. And when that happens, we're being shortchanged. And God's work doesn't do all that it could do. The solution to the boredom of wealth and always wanting more is to invest it in God's work. Invest it in people. And I welcome any ideas and any encouragement that you can give to me, short of putting people on guilt trips, which I will never do purposely, to help us learn the blessing and the joy of contributing to the work of God consistently, whatever the amount is that He guides us to do. And then finally, the reality of death. Ecclesiastes 9, he says, I reflected on this and concluded that the righteous and the wise and what they do are in God's hands, but no one knows love or hate awaits him. All share a common destiny, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad. And he develops this thing all the way through chapter 9, verse 12. And he says, no one escapes death. What's the answer to that? Well, think eternal. Be ready to meet God. And then we don't fear death. And then I titled the next section, the part that helps us. Ecclesiastes, with all of its frustrating human thinking, gives us some amazing positives. Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 11, very familiar. Often use it as funerals and adapt it and apply it to the individual. There's a time for everything, a season for every activity. And then it goes on and goes through the process of life. And we all relate to segments of this. And the beautiful thing is when it gets down to verse 9, it says, what does the worker gain from his toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on men. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men. What's the point? Get in step with God. Get in step with God. We know that an engine that's out of time doesn't run. We know that runners in a race that get off out of time with each other, they stumble and fall. They lose the race. There's a time for everything. A right time. This is such a relevant passage for everybody. Young people, there's a time for this in your life, but it's not today. Older people, there's a time for this in your life, but it's not quite there yet. Beautiful passage that there's a time for everything. And the principle is, let God work His process so that we know the beauty of that taking place. Chapter 7, verses 1 to 14 is more Proverbs. It sounds very much like the book of Proverbs. And he just slipped some more in there. And then you get to chapter 12. Probably my favorite part of the book. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come and the years approach, when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. This is an old man, I think, facing the reality of growing old. Gets very specific. Verse 2, before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grew dark, remember your Creator before you get to where you can't see Him anymore. Verse 3, when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men stoop, when the grinders cease because they are few, I think that's talking about our teeth, and those looking through the windows grow dim, I think that's probably our eyesight, and the doors to the street are closed, that's probably our ears. Hey, I'm relating to all of these. And the sound of grinding fades, and men rise up at the sound of birds, but all their songs grow faint. A bird startles you, but you can't hear them. When men are afraid of heights, of dangers in the streets, when the almond tree blossoms and the grasshopper drags himself along, and desire no longer is stirred. The young man who was so vibrant and sexually active, and all of a sudden he just has no interest in any of that. He's old and worn out. Then man goes to his eternal home, and mourners go about in the streets. Remember him before the silver cord is severed or the golden bowl is broken, before the pitcher is shattered at the spring or the wheel broken at the well, and dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. And I wrote out beside that, only if you have no hope. If we're privileged to grow old, we will experience this. There's way too many people growing older that think life is just a bummer at this point and there's nothing left for them. There's purpose in our life until God calls us home. Lillian Bauer was ready quite a while ago to go home to heaven. The last times that Carol and I saw her, she may have heard what we were saying, but she was non-responsive. And we talked to each other and said, why does God keep her here? Why did he pick 6 o'clock last Friday morning? I don't know. But her life had focus. The last time I really heard her say anything was a short time ago when she was in the hospital and she could hardly talk and she was miserable, and we went in and chatted and we were hardly there, and she looked at Carol and I and she said, well, how are you doing? That was Lillian. We need to face life and change as it comes to us in ways that are appropriate. The writer of Ecclesiastes reflected on the process, but I think he lost the purpose of what it was all about. And finally, in chapter 12, probably the best part of the whole book, verse 13, now all has been heard, plenty, I think. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep His commandments. Isn't that interesting? After all this loss of perspective and all these words of wisdom, he said, let me summarize it for you. Respect the Creator, fear Him appropriately, and obey Him. For this is the duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether good or evil. He gets the final word. You say, summarize for me how I should live life. Remember that God does everything correctly in His time, and we're to respect Him and obey Him. So as the servers come to join me and we do communion today, could we focus on that? If this was my last day on planet Earth, would I feel confident that I have been respecting the Creator and obeying him. Communion is for people who know Jesus as Savior. So if you've trusted him, if you've invited him into your life, doesn't matter what your background or church connection is, this is for you. If you haven't trusted him as your Savior, then you don't know who you're remembering, so obviously you wouldn't participate. It's a memory time. It's also a time for those of us who know Jesus to reflect on our life and say, I think that attitude was pretty crummy. I need to confess that. I think I was hasty in that decision. I need to clean that up with God. I think I failed in that area. Communion's for all of that. Brings us up to date. Brings us current. That's why we keep books, right? Every now and then we sit down and we check our finances and we make sure that things are in balance and that we haven't overlooked a bill and that we've managed properly. Kind of what communion is. And in the words of Ecclesiastes, it's a time to answer the question, do I really respect God? Do I have the right kind of attitude towards him? Am I walking in obedience? Am I recognizing that there's a time for everything and I'm in step with God's timetable, and am I making the most of this day with the right attitude because God has given me this day? We'll share the elements and then we'll eat and drink together. Father, Ecclesiastes is an interesting book. It's filled with a lot of human thinking that doesn't sound like the way you think, but it might sound way too much like the way I think from time to time. So thanks for the reminder. And I so much want to be in step with you, and I think everybody in this chapel does. So as we reflect on you and see how we're doing, speak to our hearts. Give us the courage to face the things that need to be admitted and to let your grace and your love and your cleansing blood continue to flow over our life. That we would have joy in this day regardless of the circumstances. That we would be on top of life rather than under it.